Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. The news here in the U.S. has been so unrelenting, so all-consuming, it can make it very challenging to stay up to speed with news from the rest of the world, to say the least. So today, we're going to pull away from the Washington vortex and get a thorough roundup of big global news, looking for trends and patterns that are shaping the world today, and yes, trends and patterns that could rebound back on America. This hour on Point, top journalists on the world news we need to know now. You can join us on air or online. Have you been hungry to hear more about what's going on in Germany with those riots? Should we be paying more attention to Turkey's economic crisis or the human exodus from Venezuela? The list goes on and on. So what do you want to add to it? What do you want to ask our guests about the news around the world today? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter or Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, we do have planned a great roundup of journalists today. Connection and technology makes it somewhat challenging to get a hold of some of them, but we will get them all when we, as soon as we can, on the line. But joining us first from Washington, ironically, is Kathy Gilsonen. She's senior editor covering foreign affairs for The Atlantic. Kathy, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Glad to be here.
Oh, and look, like it's the magic of radio. We've got the other folks with us, too. That's terrific. So joining us now from Beijing is David Rennie. He's joining us via Skype. He's Beijing bureau chief for The Economist. And before that, he was European Union correspondent and Washington bureau chief for The Economist magazine as well. David, are you there?
I am. Hello.
Terrific. It's good to have you. Welcome to On Point. Also with us from Berlin today is Matthew Karnichnig. He's chief Europe correspondent for Politico Europe. Matthew, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Great to be here.
It's great to have all of you. Okay, so Kathy, David, and Matthew, I just want to start off with a simple question. I mean, from your perch where you are, what do you think is, you know, the biggest piece of world news now that we ought to be focusing on? And Kathy, let me just start with you.
Sure. Well, I am in Washington, unavoidably. The thing that I'm focused on mostly is the North Korea negotiations and specifically what's not happening. Last week, as we all know, Mike Pompeo had his visit canceled to North Korea. And what we've observed happening outside the Beltway is that the South Koreans were shocked by this. The South Koreans have been really trying to push these negotiations forward. You know, they have their own interests in trying to strike a peace deal with the North Koreans and in trying to denuclearize the peninsula. And so from the South Korean perspective, this is a major setback. And from the North Korean perspective, obviously, at least officials in Washington are perceiving that the North Koreans may be getting cold feet. So we're watching.
Yeah, I mean, and it's huge to say the least. And David Rennie, let me turn to you. I want to get your sort of top story here in a second. But since you're there in Beijing, how is this decision to not send Pompeo for further negotiations, how is that being perceived in China?
Well, the bottom line is that China was really, really happy with what happened in Singapore, even if plenty of people in Washington were unhappy with the sight of Donald Trump kind of yucking it up with Kim Jong-un and giving him all of these concessions and saying that the era of maximum pressure was on hold. That was exactly what China wanted to see, because the bottom line is China can live with a sort of quietly nuclear-armed North Korea as long as things are stable and China gets to trade with North Korea. So they hated the period where Trump was talking about fire and fury. They loved seeing Trump trying to strike a deal with Kim Jong-un. And seeing Trump tied up in knots and not really getting anywhere with North Korea, that's not such a bad deal for China.
Okay, so explain a little bit more, though, about how that plays to China's interest.
So China's bottom line, which has been a great frustration for the United States and the West for a long time, is that China was worried about North Korea getting nukes, sure, but that was never China's number one worry. China's number one nightmare was a sort of collapse of the North Korean dictatorship and civil war and unrest, and then eventually a kind of messy, chaotic reunification of the Korean Peninsula with American troops on China's border. That was their nightmare. And so essentially, China has been willing to live with a very badly behaved, very cruel and repressive North Korea, as if you like a kind of buffer state or a giant prison camp for 23 million North Koreans, which suited China down to the ground. And so now seeing America tied up in knots but no longer pushing China to impose the toughest sanctions on North Korea, that's pretty good news. And you point out correctly that Donald Trump is frustrated, so has told his Secretary of State not to go. Mm. We're here in Beijing. We're expecting to see the Chinese leader, Xi Jinping, potentially going for his very first visit to the North Korean capital, Pyongyang, as soon as next month when there's a big Communist Party shindig over there. And that would be extraordinary kind of optics, that as Donald Trump loses patience with North Korea, the Chinese are there being given a kind of, no doubt, five-star red carpet right. welcome by the North Koreans.
Right. Okay. So here we are already talking about U.S. actions and how they are being interpreted abroad. So this the Trump administration having challenges with the North Korea negotiations notwithstanding. David Rennie, I mean, in China, what else is a big story that you think we ought to be paying attention to?
Well, I guess people are clearly, in America, you're focused in terms of trade news, and I'm sure we'll turn to this later, the potential of, is NAFTA dead? Is it now just a deal with the Mexicans? Will the Canadians join it? China is also wondering, are we about to have a trade war with Donald Trump, or aren't we? And you're seeing the Chinese very, very unsure of how to handle Donald Trump. And you're seeing the Chinese who thought for a long time that Donald Trump was a kind of pragmatic business guy, and surely both countries had so much to lose, they would never risk everything on a trade war. They're no longer really quite so sure how to present him. And China has an awful lot of things it wants to get done domestically. You know, it needs to generate a lot of jobs. It needs to clean up the polluted air. It's got a lot of stuff on its plate. The one thing it didn't want to have to do is try and play second guess by reading Donald Trump's tweets and trying to work out what on earth this guy in the White House has in mind for them. And a real suspicion that actually the hardest of hardliners around Donald Trump have in mind something pretty close to containing China, to blocking China's rise. And if it's that, then we could be in for a lot of very, very bumpy period.
Well, so you see, we are working hard here to try to get out of the Washington vortex. But, you know, point taken, obviously what happens in the United States, especially with American leadership, does matter around the world. But Matthew Karnichnig, let me turn to you there in Berlin. Is there a story from your perspective there in Europe that we ought to be paying attention to that perhaps Americans aren't focused on?
Well, again, I think here the impact of the Trump presidency is something that's felt very intensely every day on the political scene. But you also have other things going on, in particular the migration issue in Europe, the influx of refugees over the past couple of years. And we're seeing that continue to come up again and again with the rise of populism in Europe. Just this past weekend, we had a mob in the eastern German city of Chemnitz reacting to a murder that was allegedly committed by two refugees there. And this mob gathered afterwards and started chasing people of color through the streets of this city, really horrifying scenes. So you can really see through that example, which unfortunately isn't the first example of its kind in recent years, just how potent this issue of migration, of the refugee crisis coming out of the Syrian war remains. And that's really something that is not limited to one country. You're seeing it in Sweden up north. You're seeing it in Austria, in France, obviously, and elsewhere. And it's really something that's going to pose the biggest challenge maybe to European politics in the coming years.
Yeah, so this is really interesting, Matthew, because, I mean, there the specifics behind the drivers of populism in each one of these countries that you mentioned, there are differences to them. But it does seem, and we've been talking about this for a long time, that there is this rising wave of populism that we're seeing in the United States, throughout Europe, and even in India here, where we're seeing, you know, about stories about mobs of young men there who are mixing populism, class issues in India, along with, you know, Hindu nationalism as well. I mean, Kathy Gilson, and what do you make of this? It seems worldwide. Stories about the harder, more perhaps violent edges of populism are unavoidable.
Yeah, I I think it's an important point that the local roots of these kinds of movements are all unique. And I do wonder, and maybe Matthew has more insight on this from his perch in Berlin. I often wonder, just to your point about the Washington vortex, how much of the global populist wave is really new, or how much we in the United States are now taking new notice of it because we have this framework of Donald Trump within which to place it, right? And I think oftentimes we in Washington can slip into a mode of even thinking of these sort of these populists all around the world as essentially Trumpist. Now, Trump didn't invent scapegoating and the need to find a villain and chase after a villain and competition for resources among different populations in different parts of the world. And I think that in what it comes down to a lot of the time, it seems like from sort of a 10,000 foot view, and not having interviewed any of the populists at issue in India, for example, mm-hmm. These are, there are lots of tensions over identity playing out in a lot of parts of the world. And politics fundamentally everywhere around the world is a question about who gets what and who gets to decide how these resources are distributed. Yeah. And, how societies answer these questions can lead to things like populist mobs in India and a refugee crisis in the Southern Hemisphere, right? It's really important to get these questions right, and because people's lives are at stake.
Matthew Karnichnig, your take on that?
Well, I agree. I think it's often overlooked that this phenomenon of populism, especially in Europe, has been around for quite a while, at least going back into the early 1990s, when you had politicians really being very successful by going after foreigners and immigrants and so forth. At the time, it was more related to the Balkan Wars that were happening then. And I think ultimately what all of these movements have in common is this fear of the other and this sort of blaming of the other. And you combine that with the effects of globalization, with a sense in many sort of advanced Western countries that people are kind of being left to the wayside, that have been disenfranchised.
Matthew, I'm going to have to take it back from you there for a second, because we were heading into a break here. But we're talking about news around the world that we ought to be paying closer attention to. We're joined by Matthew Karnichnig in Berlin, David Rennie in Beijing, and Kathy Gilson in Washington. What are your questions for our panelists today? What world news do you want to know more about? I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
This is Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We do long-form interviews with the people behind the best books, pop culture, journalism, and more, so you can get to know the people whose work you love. You'll find Fresh Air on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking with a great panel of journalists today, foreign correspondents and folks posted around the world, to give us a sense about world news that perhaps we haven't had a chance to pay so much attention to because so much is happening here in the United States, but stories that nevertheless we ought to be paying attention to. I'm joined today by Matthew Karnichnig. He's in Berlin. He's chief Europe correspondent for Politico Europe. We're joined by David Rennie. He's joining us on Skype from Beijing. He's Beijing bureau chief for The Economist. And Kathy Gilsonen joins us from Washington. She's senior editor covering foreign affairs at The Atlantic. And we've got some comments coming in on our website. Sam Winston says, "I don't care about the world right now. We've got our own damn problems." And Sam, I hear you. But on the other hand, I think maybe there are some trends and some patterns that we should be paying attention to, because they could wash back up on our own shores. And David Rennie, we were talking about populism and its sort of long-term rise in Europe, and Kathy pointed to places in South America as well before the break. I wanted to ask you about similar strains that we may be seeing in Asia. We mentioned India a little bit earlier. Really fascinating, if not disturbing, a set of stories down there about rising gangs of young unemployed Indian men there who are mixing a form of a populism and Hindu nationalism and their gripes about unemployment. I mean, what's happening there?
Yes, we need to be a bit careful about our labels. I mean, if populism in the rich West is basically the kind of the claim that the good ordinary people are the honest people who look after, you know, the people who deserve protection from the government and who deserve, as your other panelists said, you know, a share of resources, and then the wicked elites are betraying them, and that's the kind of populist story in the West. Places like Asia, unfortunately, what we're dealing with is very, very long-standing sectarian disputes. In the Indian case, you know, painfully, obviously, between Hindus and Muslims. A lot of Muslims in India, though it's a Hindu country. These have been exacerbated by some gigantic demographic changes to do with things like a gigantic shortage of women. Now, this is happening in places like India. It's happening in places like China. There's debate about why these girls go missing. Some people say it's infanticide. Some people say it's selective abortion. There is some evidence that some of the girls who are missing when they take the sort of census every few years just exist and are alive but haven't been registered by their families for various reasons. But it is the case that, sadly, tragically, across large bits of the world, girls are not valued as much as boys. There is now science that allows for things like selective abortions. In India and in China, for every 100 girls born, there's something like 118 Chinese boys were found by the latest census. That's a giant gap. That translates in both India and China to tens of millions of young men who may never marry. And that then feeds into the desire of irresponsible politicians to whip up long-standing sectarian disputes around things like religion and caste. And it turns into these explosions of really serious violence. But it's got that kind of scientific modern twist of things like selective abortion.
Mm. And I mean, I'm seeing that some of these young men in these Indian gangs, if I can call them that, are very openly saying that they're operating with impunity because of, you know, the BJP and Modi, maybe if not directly saying it's okay, but not tamping down on it.
Yeah, and so I'd like to sort of address your listener who said, why should we care about foreign news when America has a ton of problems? Well, you know, one reason why you should care about foreign news is if you have large-scale chaos in poor bits of the world, certainly in Europe, but also we can see this in Latin America, when countries really get racked by really serious civil violence and unrest, you get these massive uncontrollable refugee flows. You get massive disruptions to trade flows. I mean, if you don't want to care about China, fine, but don't go shopping in places like Walmart, because a ton of the stuff on the shelves is very, very cheap because it's made in China. And so, for instance, you could want to pay attention to trade wars between America and China, because it's going to put the price of everything up at Walmart by 25-30%, which will dent a lot of ordinary people's pocketbooks. If you live in Western Europe, what happened in Syria used to seem like the kind of exotic thing on the sort of posh news channels. Now it's the reason that there are Syrians in the market square in your hometown and occasional outbreaks of kind of really nasty racist violence. If you live in Latin America and you're in Colombia and you thought that, well, I've got plenty to worry about, I'm Colombian, but then suddenly you discover that total breakdown of Venezuela, which right. I'm sure we'll turn to later perhaps, means that there's millions of Venezuelans in neighboring countries like Colombia. So what we're discovering, I think, is that one of the drivers of populism is that this is a very, very mobile, unprecedentedly mobile world in which millions of people can see a safer place on their smartphone and get on a boat or get on a plane or start walking and turn up in another country. That didn't used to happen.
Wow.
That's right. And if I can just add to that,
yeah,
from
Kathy,
the American perspective, the Venezuela refugee crisis, and you even have to bring it back to Washington again. I'm sorry, you're right about the vortex. It's really a vortex. The, you know, Donald Trump floating the idea of military intervention, not necessarily seriously, in Venezuela because of what's going on there. It's the Financial Times called the refugee crisis there probably the largest forced displacement ever in the Western Hemisphere. That's a 3.5-hour flight from Miami. Mm-hmm. It's here.
Yeah, so let's put some numbers on here, right? Because, I mean, we're seeing UN figures are saying that some 2.3 million Venezuelans have left Venezuela over the past couple of years. Some other groups say that that might be a low estimate. I'm seeing numbers closer to 4 million. I mean, the country's economy has shrunk by, what, half in just the past 5 years? Inflation at an unimaginable 1 million percent here. So, I mean, Kathy, give us a little bit more insight. I mean, the government of Nicolas Maduro is obviously not leading a healthy country right now. What's going on?
I think you're right to use the phrase unimaginable. One of the ways that some clever journalists, I think at Reuters, tried to paint a picture of this was by showing, you know, you can't wrap your mind around how high the inflation is there and what that really means. So there's a photo gallery on Reuters of basically foodstuffs like tomatoes stacked against the stacks and stacks of bolivars that it would take to buy them. And, you know, the towers of cash that these goods are valued at now dwarfs the size of the actual goods. But, you know, this has been it's been a long-running, slow-moving crisis since oil prices dropped a couple of years ago. Maduro's predecessor, Hugo Chavez, had set up this sort of patronage socialist system wherein he was distributing oil revenues to the poor and others. And this was massively popular. And Chavez was an extremely charismatic figure. What you have now is his successor is less charismatic, by some measures more authoritarian, and he doesn't have the resources to distribute. And so this economic mismanagement is with the commodity price collapse is really coming to the fore.
Well, Kathy, can I just jump here for a second? Because I've got a little bit of tape here of the voice of a Venezuelan migrant. Al Jazeera spoke to migrant and former law student Julio Wadua last week, and Julio had hoped to reach Peru before Peruvian authorities began enforcing new immigration restrictions.
We are not regular immigrants. We are displaced by the dictatorship that has kidnapped our country. Kids are dying of hunger. The elderly, for a lack of medicine, and the young, who should be the main engine of the country, are leaving penniless.
Kathy, what I'm curious about is now, I'm seeing that, like you said, Peru and Brazil and other nations are starting to say very clearly that there needs to be a regional response here, that that the problem is so huge, the spillover has to be contained somehow. What are they saying?
Well, so this is, and this brings up two other trends that we're seeing in other parts of the country. One of them is that in response to an outflow of refugees, countries close their borders, right? We saw this happen in Europe. Merkel was one of the famous exceptions to this rule, but now she's paying a political price for it. And again, you have human beings, millions of human beings who cannot buy medicine, who cannot get diapers for their kids, either because of severe shortages or because they just don't have the money, trying to vote with their feet and get a better life. The other thing it showcases is the popularity of scapegoating, right? So the region has been critical of Venezuela for a long time. Obviously, they're seeing the effects of economic mismanagement in Venezuela spill over beyond their borders. They've criticized the regime. They've kicked it out of regional bodies. You know, you're seeing Maduro scapegoating them. There was recently what the government calls an assassination attempt on Maduro by flying drone, in fact. And Maduro blamed the Colombians. Hmm. And the Colombians said, this is ridiculous. You know, you're whipping up conspiracy theories to try and maintain support, which to me, I don't think anybody knows the particular details of that case yet. But it's a standard authoritarian play to say, no, your problem is really not me and the policies that I'm pushing that are causing you to suffer. It's those people. It's those people out there.
Well, I see a really interesting, there was an interesting op-ed in the Washington Post where a Venezuelan commentator and a strong Maduro critic, Francisco Toro, he said that, quote, all Venezuela demonstrates is that if you leave implementation to the very worst, most anti-intellectual, callous, authoritarian, and criminal people in society, socialism can have genuinely horrendous consequences. But can't that be said of every ideology? Okay, so we've got a lot of listeners who want to join us. We're talking about the news around the world that we haven't been paying as much attention to, or maybe we should, because they might represent some trends, some patterns that could wash back up on American shores. I'm joined by Kathy Gilsonen and David Rennie, who's in Beijing, and Matthew Karnichnig, who's in Berlin. So let's go to Janice, who's calling from Woodstock, Maine. You're on the air, Janice.
Thanks for taking my call, Magna. I'm just really frustrated because now I get my news from Deutsche Welle, the BBC, and Vice, because the local channels don't report what's going on in the world and things that affected us. I think part of the reason we have such deny of climate change is we don't even talk about it in this country. We don't have to even have the debate whether it exists or not. We all know it does. But for those that don't think it exists, if we just reported on stories of what it's doing, it might sink in that it's something real. So I think we do ourselves a disservice by not talking about what's going on around the world. And I think people would benefit if our news would focus on news stories and not the fluff pieces about the kids' lemonade stand or all the other little stories. Let that go to entertainment TV. But we need to be educated over here, because I'm very sad that this country is becoming less and less educated on what's happening in the world.
Well, Janice, let me just ask you here really quickly. I mean, we've got David Rennie in Beijing and Matthew Karnichnig in Berlin. I mean, do you have a specific question for them? Something you might want to know more? I mean, they're there.
I really don't have something specific. I don't want to take up too much time of your time on the air. I said, I get a lot of my news from Deutsche Welle, which I think is awesome. I mean, I hear about what's going on in India and Turkey, and I get that from Deutsche Welle. Sadly, I don't hear any of it over here in this country.
All right. Well, Janice, I appreciate your call and your perspective there. Thank you so very, very much. Matthew Karnichnig, I'm going to turn to you with a question here, because, you know, turning back to Europe, you know, we're seeing over the past couple of weeks that some key European leaders, Emmanuel Macron in France and the German foreign minister, again, this sadly links back to the United States, but, you know, that these European leaders are actually saying that they have to imagine a future without U.S. leadership or their being allies of the U.S. being as central to their policies on how they operate. What's going on there?
Well, there's definitely growing disenchantment here between the U.S. and Europe, and you really feeling it almost every day here on the ground. And you know, you cited those examples of the German foreign minister and Macron recently, but you know, even as long ago as last year, Angela Merkel started making similar statements, although not quite as vociferously. And I think, you know, what you're seeing is a gradual realization, or at least this is the feeling on the part of the Europeans, that they're not going to be able to count on the U.S. in the same way that they used to. But, you know, I think what's interesting about this recent ratcheting up of the rhetoric is that you're hearing statements such as that from the German foreign minister, saying that the U.S. and Europe increasingly don't share the same values, which previously would have been, you know, unthinkable for any mainstream European leader really to posit, and now it's not even seen here as that controversial, and they're really focusing on, well, what can we do about it? And I think there's a lot of frustration in Europe in general, because they're slowly realizing that it's not going to be that easy to get along without the U.S., because the U.S. has guaranteed European security since World War II, essentially. And the other big issue here is that the economies of the two spheres are so tightly intertwined. That said, Europe is more dependent on the U.S. than vice versa. If you take Germany, for example, Germany exports over $100 billion in goods to the U.S. every year, and Germany imports only about $50 or $60 billion, rather, from the U.S. So there is this dependence on the U.S. market in many different ways, and in the security sphere is another one, and this is something that Merkel has brought up in recent days, trying to pull back some of her ministers, saying, you know, she doesn't want them to be too critical about the relationship with the U.S. because the Europeans rely very heavily on U.S. intelligence, for example, regarding terrorism and similar issues. And just a couple of months ago, they foiled a suspected Iranian plot outside of Paris to blow up a convention there with the help of U.S. intelligence.
Yeah.
So I think that there's a lot of sort of soul searching going on here about what to do about it.
Well, so let me turn back to Beijing and David Rennie there. I mean, how does China? What's the Chinese view of what seemed to be cracks in these key U.S.-Europe alliances?
It's absolutely a fascinating question. I mean, I think the Chinese don't know yet whether to be gleeful because the West is falling apart in front of their eyes, or whether it's a little alarming to find China kind of thrust into potentially a kind of global leadership role probably a little sooner than China was expecting. I think for the moment, the Chinese are still fairly cautious about the idea that they could, say, peel the Europeans away from the Americans. We saw a really interesting kind of brief attempt by the Chinese in the spring of this year when Donald Trump was pushing Europeans very hard on trade and slapping tariffs on European steel and aluminium. And you saw the Chinese kind of sidle up to the European Union and say, well, maybe you and I could be best friends and we could push against that awful Donald Trump. And they were actually sounding out the Europeans about even doing stuff together at the World Trade Organization, kind of launching lawsuits against America. And the Europeans pushed back very firmly and said, that's not where we're going. We're still basically fundamentally part of the West. So the Chinese learned a lesson from that. They're pushing back, but they're watching and wondering if this is their chance.
Well, we will be back in just a minute to talk a lot more about Myanmar, about Yemen, and about certain trade agreements involving the North American continent. I'm joined today by David Rennie. He's in Beijing. Kathy Gilson, and she's in Washington. And Matthew Karnichnig, he's in Berlin. And we're talking about the world news we ought to know. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
I'm Linda Holmes. There's more stuff to watch these days than you can ever get to. That's why we make Pop Culture Happy Hour. Twice a week, we give you the lowdown on what's worth your time and what's not. Find Pop Culture Happy Hour on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are trying to step out of the Washington vortex for just a minute and talk about the world news that maybe we haven't been paying as close enough attention to as we should, but also at the same time, seeking out those patterns, those trends in those global news stories that could wash back here on the United States. I'm joined today by Kathy Gilson, and she's with us from Washington. She's senior editor covering foreign affairs at The Atlantic. David Rennie is with us from Beijing. He's Beijing bureau chief for The Economist. And Matthew Karnichnig joins us from Berlin. He's chief Europe correspondent for Politico Europe. And I want to talk with all three of you about, there's a bunch of major human rights stories around the world. And to that point, Rion Thum has sent us a tweet. This is a question for you, David. She looks like Rion didn't love the fact that you looked at U.S.-China trade as a major story. She says, you're breaking my heart. Hundreds of thousands of minorities in extrajudicial internment camps. More to come, question mark, she asks. So I think Rion is asking about China interning Uyghurs. I'm seeing that a million of Chinese Uyghurs are potentially held in political camps, or at least that's what's been told to the United Nations. What's going on there, David?
So your listener makes a good point about, you know, it's hard to know sometimes how to cover very long-running stories as opposed to breaking news stories. But The Economist, my own magazine, we put this on the cover a couple of months ago. There is an absolutely appalling human rights crisis underway in the far western region of Xinjiang, which is basically home to a large number, millions of Uyghurs, who are essentially a Turkic people. They don't look like Chinese people. They don't have the same language. They're mostly Muslims. And because of fears, Chinese fears of separatism and Chinese probably exaggerated fears of Islamic terrorism, they have built these labor camps and now re-education camps. And the numbers are very, very hard to assess because, you know, reporting is incredibly hard to do in Xinjiang without getting people locked up just for giving an interview to a foreign journalist. But certainly credible reports of, you know, potentially hundreds of thousands of people locked in re-education camps without trial for crimes like, crimes in inverted commas, like having phoned someone abroad, having visited someone abroad, having an Islamic app on your smartphone when the police put your smartphone in a digital reader. So your listener's absolutely right. This is a chronic, long-running, very, very grave human rights crisis. It's hard to know how to weigh those against some of the more urgent breaking news. I guess that's a judgment all of us have to make in our business all the time.
Well, I suppose if you're a Uyghur, it is very urgent. I mean, if the Chinese are using the justification of protecting against religious extremism to imprison, perhaps starve and torture people simply for having Muslim apps on their smartphones, I mean, isn't this something that the global community should be paying more attention to?
It absolutely should. I think you can see a difference in certain countries' approaches. So we have seen, for example, the German government being fairly vocal about this. They've got a policy now that they will not deport people back to China who are Uyghurs when the Chinese request it. It's a big issue in Turkey, which has very close sort of ties of religion and language with the Uyghurs. The tragic truth is that I suspect that if this were brought to the attention of the Trump administration, the idea of weighing in on behalf of Muslims accused of extremism by the Chinese government probably isn't top of the American mind. In fact, in recent years, the Americans have tried to win Chinese support for stuff that America cares about by saying to the Chinese, we could help you with tracking, for example, Uyghurs who go to fight with the Taliban in Afghanistan. So treating it as a kind of opportunity for cooperation on counterterrorism. It's a really horrendous long-running story that's been running for years and years, but there seems to be a sense now that China's kind of use of 21st century high-tech surveillance, facial recognition, devices that can scan your smartphone from a distance is being used in a kind of unbelievably dystopian way to build this 21st century surveillance police state in Xinjiang.
Yeah. Well, Kathy Gilson, let me turn to you here because we've got a comment on our website. Adam sent this message. He says, there's three things I want to know about. One, Yemen. Two, Yemen. Three, Yemen. I mean, yeah. we have the human rights experts in Geneva saying this week that those Saudi-led airstrikes in Yemen have caused so many heavy civilian casualties they may amount to war crimes. And I'm seeing here that Secretary of Defense James Mattis isn't withdrawing U.S. support from that Saudi-led coalition, but also saying that support is not unconditional.
It's interesting and horrible that this is, you know, this is one of the major humanitarian crises in the world in which the U.S. is, if not an active participant, an active facilitator of the Saudi-led air campaign that is that has killed such a large number of civilians and also wiped out enough infrastructure that that a lot of people don't have access to food. You know, humanitarian groups can't get access to people in need. This is also, it should be said, that there are also other combatants blocking humanitarian access to civilians. But, you know, the Houthis, which is the rebel group controlling the capital right now, they don't have an air force. So they're not able to inflict as much catastrophic damage on the civilian population as the Saudis are. Now, the U.S. position is that essentially part of the reason we participate in the Saudi-led coalition is, A, because, you know, they're our allies and they claim to be fighting a threat on their southern border, which isn't entirely a pretext, right? You have seen Houthis try and fire some rockets into Saudi Arabia. The Saudis play up the still somewhat murky degree of Iranian support for the Houthis and say, you know, this is an existential threat to us. Obviously, the Trump administration also sees Iran as a threat. So they have that sort of containing Iran, counter Iran strategy in mind as well. And then I also think, you know, some of the things that Mattis indicated yesterday is, look, if we weren't participating, if we weren't helping with targeting and smart bombs and things like that, this would be worse. Now, you can argue with that because smart munitions are only as smart as the intelligence that's guiding them. And obviously, as we saw recently with the bombing of a school bus, you know, if you have precise munitions precisely targeted at school buses, you're going to kill dozens of children.
You know, I'm seeing here that Lieutenant General Jeffrey Harrigan was quoted in the or Harrigian, if I can say that correctly. Anyway, he was quoted in the New York Times saying that there's a level of frustration that needs to be acknowledged, right? That the Saudis need to come out and say what happened regarding that bus bombing with those children on board. But David Rennie, Matthew Karnichnig, let me get your view here because, you know, we had a discussion about Yemen last week and an overarching theme was that of any member of the global community, because of the United States' close relationship with Saudi Arabia, that the U.S. has the most leverage to perhaps change the equation in Yemen, to push a solution into the United Nations, but it's not exercising that leverage as much as it could. I mean, how is that viewed there in Europe?
Well, I think to David's point, I mean, this is another one of these situations, unfortunately, has been going on for so long that it doesn't get the attention it deserves. And certainly in Europe, it's not anywhere near the top of the political agenda. And the degree to which it is sort of noticed, it falls into the larger sort of question of Iran and how to deal with Iran and the tensions between Israel and Iran and the U.S. So I think, you know, Germany certainly has been an actor here that wants to push for a solution. They're going to be joining the Security Council early next year, I believe, and they've made it clear that they want to move forward on this and to try to create some kind of peace process there. But it's not looking very, very hopeful at the moment, certainly.
Yeah. Well, let's get a call here. Peter is calling from Warren, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Peter.
Hello, Magna. This show, by the way, is totally magnificent. You could do this every single day and cover so many bloody things. But just look north to Canada. I mean, there's, of course, the whole NAFTA thing where Chrystia Freeland is woke to struggle with. But the relationship between the States and Canada, where I'm very deeply connected, has been so deep for so long, through World War II and World War I, where we all struggled with heroic toil to hopefully serve a greater good. And to have this rent apart by, frankly, an individual, Mr. Trump, who is reminding me more and more of, 30s Germany, where a host of my French family were killed. And it just breaks my heart. But what is happening is the view in the North from friends is, and myself, I regret to say, is changing. But I'm here. You know?
Peter, can I just jump in here? I'm so sorry to interrupt you. I really don't mean to. I'm just kind of keeping my eye on the clock here to be sure we have a chance to give our guests a chance to respond. Thank you so much for your call. Peter, Kathy, let me just turn back to you here. I mean, Peter's got a big critique right now of where he sees the relationship between the United States and Canada, but let's just drill in on one part of that. I mean, NAFTA could be undergoing some changes sometime soon. We don't know exactly what yet, and there's still so many uncertain questions. But what aspect of at least trade agreements between the U.S. and Canada should we be paying attention to?
Dairy. In a word, dairy. One of my proudest headlines that I wrote for the Atlantic website was Trump's beef with Canadian dairy. One of the issues that is bedeviling the current NAFTA talks are Canadian tariffs on dairy imports, which is interesting because the United States actually has a trade surplus in dairy with the Canadians. And it's also interesting because the Canadians, first of all, have irritated other countries, including New Zealand, that want better access to the Canadian dairy market with these tariffs. But we're prepared to concede on them as part of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, massive free trade agreement that, of course, Trump withdrew from. In any case, this has not historically been part of the NAFTA agreement. Trump is pushing for Canadians to agree to lower dairy tariffs as part of staying in the agreement. He struck a side deal with Mexico that I imagine he, and perhaps correctly, sees as leverage against the Canadians. And so now it's the Canadians' move to... And they've signaled also that they may be open to moving on dairy tariffs. But of course, also the U.S. dairy industry is well protected as well. So to me, it looks like the debate is less about fairness of trade writ large than it is about trying to get advantage for America, which, you know, in Trump's and I think a lot of American voters' worldview is exactly what a president is supposed to do, right? Push American interests.
But I think that's just right at the core of the tension with Europe as well, because I think when you talk to Europeans, what you hear is that the U.S. has suddenly moved from this value-based system that has dominated the post-war era into this more transactional approach that they're really uncomfortable with. And I think a lot of people here thought after Trump was elected and after his sort of first criticism of NATO and the trade situation and so forth, they were hoping that this would be temporary and that, you know, the worst case scenario, they could sort of wait out his presidency and someone else would come in and things would go back to normal. And I think what you're seeing now is there's a sense that this could really be a permanent shift. And in fact, Chrystia Freeland, who the caller mentioned, was here in Berlin just yesterday. And, you know, they were discussing the possibility of setting up this alliance of the willing, as they call it, this sort of group of second-tier powers that might include Canada, Germany, and Japan, and some others. So you can really see that this is something that is occupying the political mind space at the moment.
Well, we've just got a couple minutes left to go. David Rennie, let me turn back to you in Beijing there, because there is a story that we haven't touched on at all that's sort of not related to politics or trade or populism, which seem to be some of the big themes that we've had going this hour. It has to do with China not handing over samples of what look to be a very virulent form of bird flu there. What's going on?
Well, China has form. So listeners may remember that a few years ago, there was a very nasty outbreak of avian influenza bird flu where it mutates and it basically it can be transmitted to humans as opposed to really only passing among birds. And the Chinese, this was many years ago now, basically hushed it up and didn't report it. And so that meant that the world took a lot longer than it should have done to respond. China's got a lot better since then, has signed up to some international agreements where when there's a nasty virulent strain that seems to have mutated, there's a sort of protocol that big governments share this immediately among themselves. The complaint from the American side, from people like the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, and other scientists in the States, is that it's taken a year of asking, and still China has not handed over samples of this very virulent strain that at the moment is only very virulent among animals, doesn't seem to have become the sort of the pandemic that everyone is frightened about that is easily transmitted to humans. But that's a year lost in terms of global influenza scientists trying to study this strain and working out how dangerous it is. So this is the kind of thing that makes China not your regular superpower. It's another example of a place that has got very, very big, very powerful, but is still behaving like a smaller, less responsible power because it's so secretive and obsessed with control.
But why is China not, why are they saying they're not handing over the samples?
So there's various theories, and it depends how dark you want to be. I mean, one of the ones that I think the New York Times aired was the theory that China sees this as a kind of leverage, that it can use this as, you know, if you want this stuff so badly, then what are you going to give us on other unrelated areas like trade? Now, I don't know if that is too conspiratorial or whether this is simply a very secretive system which doesn't particularly like dealing with foreign scientists. But there's no doubt that it's another classic example of a country which is kind of like a gawky adolescent that is getting very, very strong and very, very large, but is clumsy with it and is not behaving like a kind of superpower waiting to be.
Hmm. Well, as we wrap up today, we've got so many comments coming in. Listener DXO says on our website that the biggest world story, climate change, period. It is everywhere. The signs are everywhere. And runaway capitalism is keeping the U.S., especially in a state of denial. Stefanos Karavas says on our website, beyond the Washington vortex, let's look at populism's electoral victories in Europe, Italy's looming banking crisis, Turkey's worsening currency crisis, the immediate impact of Brexit's finalization threatening to plunge Europe into another period of economic uncertainty. So much news to cover all the time. And I just want to say thank you so much to Kathy Gilson, and senior editor covering foreign affairs at The Atlantic, with us today from Washington. Kathy, thanks so much for getting us thinking.
Thanks for having me. I learned a lot.
And David Rennie joining us via Skype from Beijing, Beijing bureau chief for The Economist. Many thanks, David.
Pleasure.
And Matthew Karnichnik in Berlin. Thank you so much, Matthew.
Thank you.
He's chief Europe correspondent for Politico Europe. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.